We're going to begin in just 1 minute following a brief video.
On any given day, about 1 in 25 hospital patients have an infection caused by their medical care. Almost half of these patients are 65 or older. There are five places where patients are most likely to get infections: in the bloodstream, the urinary tract, the gut, and the two most common places are the site of surgery and the lungs. The germs most likely to cause healthcare-associated infections include C. difficile or deadly diarrhea, staph, including the drug-resistant type known as MRSA, a family of germs known as Enterobacteriaceae that includes CRE, the nightmare bacteria, Enterococcus, which can be resistant to an important antibiotic, vancomycin, and Pseudomonas, which can cause infections of the lungs and bloodstream. One in every nine patients who gets an infection will die during their hospitalization. Over the last several years, great progress has been made in preventing some infections. For example, bloodstream infections in patients with central lines have been nearly cut in half in the last 5 years. But more work needs to be done. CDC's goal is to eliminate all healthcare-associated infections. We work 24/7 to save lives and protect people.
Again, welcome to CDC's media briefing on healthcare-associated infections. I'd like to welcome not only those, our guests in the room and media, but also those who are joining us via webcast and satellite today. I'd like to introduce our two speakers. First speaking will be Dr. Michael Bell, who is an expert in infection prevention and patient safety. Dr. Bell has traveled the world providing infection prevention consultation for outbreaks of common germs and exotic viruses like Ebola or Nipah. Dr. Bell is currently the Deputy Director of the CDC's Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion. The division is responsible for patient safety issues in medical facilities. With Dr. Bell's leadership, the division creates infection prevention guidelines, researches new prevention strategies, investigates outbreaks in healthcare facilities, and provides world-class laboratory expertise for microbes that cause healthcare-related infections, including antibiotic-resistant threats. Also joining us today is Mrs. Victoria Nahum of Atlanta, co-founder and executive director of the Safe Care Campaign. She has a compelling story to tell, and we are so pleased that Victoria is able to join us today to represent patients nationally who have been impacted by healthcare-associated infections. Following their brief remarks, we will open it up for questions. Dr. Bell?
Good afternoon. Sooner or later, everyone is likely to become a patient somewhere. We go to the hospital hoping to get better, and in many cases we do, but not always. As a doctor, I want all of my patients to become well and stay healthy, but some things stand in the way, including healthcare-associated infections. CDC is known for handling outbreaks, but it's even more important to be scanning the horizon for the next important threat that needs to be tackled. We undertook a major study to find out what kinds of infections are affecting patients in hospitals and understand just how big the problem is. The report shows that, as a nation, we're moving in the right direction, but there's a great deal of work still to be done. Despite the progress that we've seen, 750,000 patients every year end up with healthcare-associated infections. We found that on any given day, as you saw in the graphic, one out of 25 hospitalized patients has an infection, and of those people, as many as one out of nine go on to die. This is not a minor issue. The comparisons that you're likely to want to make, I'll just mention, are with the 2007 report that was based on historical information going back into the late 90s. I want to caution you that this is not necessarily apples to apples, even though it's tempting to try to do that. It's more like apples to pears. You can definitely see that there's a trend for things being better, but the minor details probably aren't directly comparable. The report we're releasing today is important because it was intentionally designed to gather this infection. So I think the quality of those data are actually better than what we've had to work with before. The report itself sounds the alarm about the threats that we need to be addressing. It tells us that, as you saw, lung infections, gut infections, infections related to surgery, infections related to urinary catheters, are at the top of the list of things that are causing problems for hospital patients. It also shines the light on several important pathogens. These are the germs that are responsible for many of these infections. At the top of the list is Clostridium difficile, or C. diff. C. diff causes antibiotic-related diarrhea. And in the past, going back 12 years ago or so, it was more of a nuisance than anything else. But today, the type of bacteria that is spread in this country has such a strong toxin that it is a very severe infection requiring colon removal in some cases, and that deadly diarrhea is contributing to an unacceptable number of infections. Staph infections continue to be a problem, including the antibiotic resistance type, MRSA. And then finally, we're seeing a lot of infections related to the Enterobacteriaceae. This is a family of bacteria that includes E. coli, Klebsiella, many common organisms that live in the gut and need to be there for us to be healthy. The challenge that we see is that some of those bacteria, the nightmare bacteria, are now completely untreatable. That means that as a doctor, I have nothing left I can offer a patient who has an infection like this in the hospital. The microbes that we're talking about right now also are in last year's antibiotic resistance threat report. That's the report that we released looking at how much of a problem antibiotic resistance is. They're also at the center of the President's FY15 budget initiative, where he's trying to drive progress by cutting some of these infections by 50% or more in 5 years. This is a major and important investment in making sure that hospital care remains safe. It's not all bad news. Some of the successes that we're seeing are in protecting the most fragile patients, the patients in intensive care units. We've seen very good progress preventing bloodstream infections related to central lines. Central lines are the plastic catheters that go in through the skin, off of the neck, into the major vessels of the heart. These are very important tools. We need them to provide good medical care. We need them to deliver medication. But they're also a freeway for bacteria to get into the bloodstream. And so making sure that we handle those catheters perfectly every time is a major push that we've made. And we've seen that the number of these infections has gone down by almost half since 2008. This is great progress. There's more work to be done. Similarly, we're seeing progress in infections related to surgery. Of the group of 10 surgery types that are captured in this report, we've seen about a 20% reduction in infections after surgery, also since 2008. Is 20% enough? I don't think so. But the progress is moving in the right direction. In contrast, urinary tract infections related to catheters in the bladder are being more stubborn. We're not seeing the same kind of rapid progress. In a way, maybe that's not a big deal because they're not as severe an infection. People don't tend to die immediately from a bladder infection the way they do from a bloodstream infection. But the problem is, bladder infections related to catheters are a major driver of broad-spectrum antibiotic use. When broad-spectrum antibiotics are given, it wipes out those normal bacteria in the gut and opens the door for much bigger problems like C. diff. So you think you're having a trivial infection of the bladder, and the next thing you know, you're fighting for your life because of deadly diarrhea. So we take catheter-associated urinary tract infections very seriously, and the fact that we're seeing a stalling out of progress is something that we're working on very specifically. The challenge with antibiotic resistance really can't be overstated. We found that over half of hospitalized patients end up getting an antibiotic at some point. This is a huge amount of antibiotic pressure, and we're focusing on improving the prescribing of antibiotics specifically because these nightmare bacteria and the deadly diarrhea are such a threat to patient health. We want to see every hospital in this country having a strong antibiotic stewardship program so that they can help make sure that all prescriptions are as sound and appropriate as possible. So how else do we use the information that we're reporting? The data we provide at CDC drives action. At the state and federal levels, we use this data to find the facilities that are struggling with one or more types of infection. And then we try to target our resources towards those areas that need help the most. Using this targeted approach, we've seen several successes at the state level. For example, in Florida, there's been a 35% reduction of those catheter-associated urinary tract infections. This is great. Similarly, in Georgia, right here at home, we've cut bloodstream infections in babies in ICUs by almost a half. So this targeted approach is a way to use limited resources, because no one's flush with money right now, as effectively as possible, targeting the biggest part of the problem. Lastly, I'd like to say a word about what can you do as a patient. I'm always asked, what is it that I can do to protect myself in the hospital or a loved one? The short answer is ask questions. It's hard, but you have to ask questions. And the questions to ask are things like, have you washed your hands? It sounds basic, but it's very important. And you can ask it in a nice way. You can say, I'm sure you just washed your hands, but it would mean a lot to me and my mother if you'd wash them again, because we're very worried about infections in the hospital. You can ask questions about the catheters that you have. If you have a catheter in place, ask every day, can the catheter come out today? In fact, before you have a catheter put in, when you're talking to, for example, your surgeon, ask her, how long will I have to have a catheter after my procedure? And if she says 2 days, then starting day two, start asking, can the catheter come out today? They said it would come out today. Finally, ask about testing. Are you doing tests to make sure that I'm on the right antibiotic? And if so, you know, tell me about it. These questions are very hard to ask if you're a patient receiving care. You've got plenty to think about. I think it's a good idea to bring a friend or a family member whose main job it is to be the persistent asker of those questions. Because at the end of the day, the doctors, the nurses, the entire medical team wants you to get better. And even though it might be annoying for a minute, it's a helpful reminder to have hand washing, catheter removal, and appropriate antibiotic use be at the top of their minds. There's a huge amount of information in these reports that we're releasing today, but I don't want to lose sight of the fact that every number that you see in the report is a person. These are patients who went to the hospital to receive care, and in some cases they got infections that kept them in the hospital longer, and in a few cases they died. This is something that drives the efforts at CDC to eliminate healthcare-associated infections. I wish I could be introducing our next speaker under very different circumstances, but I'm honored nonetheless to share the podium today with Mrs. Victoria Nahum. She is the co-founder and executive director of the Safe Care Campaign, and she and her husband, Armando, are strong and tireless advocates for patient safety. Her story brings home the importance of the issue, and frankly, it's why we're all here today.
Thank you, Dr. Bell. Good afternoon. In an 11-month period between November 2006 and October 2007, three different members of my family, representing three different generations of my family, were infected by healthcare-associated infections in three different hospitals in three different states. And so at the end of that time, we lost our son Joshua to a drug-resistant gram-negative infection that surrounded his brain, and it was so virulent that it actually pushed part of his brain into his spinal column. And in doing so, it effectively rendered him a permanent ventilator-dependent quadriplegic. And so 2 weeks later, Joshua died from his infection. He was only 27. So in our grief and trying to understand, you know, how and why these infections were so frequently appearing all over the country, my husband Armando and I, we reached out to the CDC for answers living in Atlanta. They were close by, and I want to tell you that graciously they met with us, and in the 8 years since our original meeting, they have become great partners and mentors and encouragers in our work to prevent other families from experiencing similar fates. Our organization, the Safe Care Campaign, works with hospitals and healthcare systems to help them do just that. So these new infection numbers, the data shared today, represents a forward stride in our shared work. Components, including guidelines, turned into checklists and data transparency and public reporting, as well as pay-for-performance initiatives, have all helped prevent infection, unnecessary harm, and many tragic deaths. And I want to tell you that while inwardly I breathe a small sigh of relief that annual infections and mortalities are diminishing, I want to tell you that I remain extremely cautious regarding the growing threat of antibiotic resistance and the dire impact of its potential danger to American healthcare. Today, I want people, healthcare workers, and patients alike to understand that they have the power, you guys have the power to prevent healthcare-associated infections. Professional caregivers can make the definitive difference by practicing compulsive hand hygiene and always following other best practices at the bedside. And patients can actually prevent their own infections and potential infections in their loved ones by doing easy things like Dr. Bell suggested when he was up here a few minutes ago, things like asking questions, insisting on proper hand hygiene every time by anyone who touches them, even their family members, and especially their doctor, and educating themselves on how to safely receive medical care. This is really important. You know, you just don't flop down and say, take care of me. You have to kind of navigate what's going to happen to you, and in doing so, that can save your own life. So thankfully, it seems that we are realizing once and for all that we're all in this together, and yet our singular and very personal roles in how we deliver as well as receive care leaves us accountable for our own actions. Thank you so much.
Well, I hope you appreciate as much as I do the courage and conviction that it takes to share that story and continue to work for such an important cause. It's certainly why CDC has made this such a high priority. Diane, on the phone, if you could give instructions to our callers, I'll take questions from the room now, please.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. You'll be prompted to record your name. To withdraw your request, please press star 2. One moment, please, while we wait for the first question.
Please.
Thanks. It's Aaron with NBC. The statistic of 1 in 9 patients who die, I'm assuming, and I just want to clarify, that's as a result of the hospital-acquired infection. It wasn't another comorbidity that may have occurred.
That's a perfect question. No. So of all the patients who had infections, 1 out of 9 of them went on to die during their hospital stay. So there is a possibility that there was something else contributing to that death, but it's difficult to tease that out. So we've simplified the number as 1 in 9.
Were there any states that stood out as performing well with reducing infections? Any states that performed worse? Do you have that sort of comparison?
I wish there were. If there was a perfect state, we could copy everything they're doing and spread it across the other 49. If there was one that was particularly terrible, we could put all of our resources there. As it turns out, state by state, some places are having success with some infections, not so much with others. So it's a very mixed picture. Other questions in the room? Diane, do we have a question on the phone, please?
Yes, we do. We have a question from Mike Stobe, Associated Press. Your line is open.
Thank you for taking my question. Your announcement today could be taken by some as good news.
Diane, we just lost Mike on the overhead. Perhaps we lost Diane as well.
One moment. We'll get him right back on the line again.
Okay. Just
bear with me. Your line is open, Mike.
Okay. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you for taking the question. What you presented today could be seen by some as good news. These are numbers that suggest old estimates that suggested that there were nearly 2.5 times as many hospital infections in a year as the numbers you presented from the 2011 survey. I guess I was wondering if you could talk to a little bit more about the context of this data. I mean, where are we in the evolution of data collection? You said a little bit about that, but and you talked about the apples and pears, but are these really the most solid numbers we've had? And if there have been improvements in fighting hospital infections, could you say a little more about what generally type of measures have accounted, for example, the improvement in bloodstream infections that you mentioned? If you could address that. Thanks.
So first and foremost, this is probably the best quality of data that we've had in a very long time
to look at the burden and type of infections that we're seeing in healthcare. The previous estimates, I think, are useful in a very big picture, non-granular kind of way to say that it used to be bigger, now it seems to be smaller. But they definitely aren't the same methodology, so I wouldn't compare them directly. But I think it's fair to say that there seems to be a trend. The reason for doing this became clear just when we did the original publication in 2007, where we had to use all sorts of different publications and data sources to cobble together a picture. That led to the process that allowed us to do the survey that we were publishing today, but it took a pilot in 2009, followed by expansion in the next year, and that process was a direct response to the difficulty of getting a burden estimate from the previous publication. Having said that, this is more than just that burden estimate. The places where we've seen success are things, are infections like central line-associated bloodstream infections, ventilator-associated pneumonias, things that happen in intensive care units. Originally, this was the place where the sickest patients were. These were the infections that had the greatest threat to patient well-being, and those were the things that we focused on up front. These are also the things that we follow month by month, year by year, in the National Healthcare Safety Network. We track these things, and that's part of what populates the progress report that was also released. At the same time, we need to be thinking about what we're not measuring in that fixed system. And this prevalence survey allows us to look at every infection happening on that day and figuring out what else is out there. And some of that what else is the pneumonias, for example. Of the pneumonias that made up almost 25% of infections, a lot of those, more than half, had nothing to do with the intensive care unit. These were pneumonias in patients on the ward. Well, what are those? We're in the process right now of teasing that apart so that we can understand what the next level of prevention is. So in the intensive care unit, we know that if you raise the head of the bed, do meticulous oral care so that there's less bacteria building up there, and reduce sedation so you can get people off the ventilator as soon as possible, these things are associated with preventing those pneumonias. What is the equivalent bundle of practices for a patient who's not on a ventilator? Is it perhaps related to sedation? Could it be that these people are using tranquilizers because hospitals, let's face it, are noisy places? Right, but maybe the downside of getting a good night's sleep is you're more likely to accidentally inhale saliva or stomach contents and get a pneumonia. We don't know if that's the case, but if it is, it leads to some very clear prevention steps that we can implement to prevent those infections. On the other hand, if we see that a lot of these infections are caused by, for example, pneumococcus, there's a vaccine for that, and maybe we need to be doing a better job of making sure everyone's immunized against that preventable infection. So this is an opportunity for us to look very clearly at the places that we're not routinely measuring and say which of these things needs to have that level of attention directed towards it next. Another big chunk of this was the deadly diarrhea, Clostridium difficile. When we see that many infections caused by that one pathogen, it's yet another piece of scaffolding that supports our drive for better antibiotic prescribing. The need for good antibiotic stewardship programs in every hospital is further emphasized by the number of infections that we're seeing by those organisms. So that's how we're using this particular study to find where else we need to look and also to get a better estimate of how much of a problem there is. We have a couple in the room. Please, whoever was first, don't fight.
Hi, I'm Diana Davis from WSB in Atlanta. What you just alluded to and mentioned some of the things you're looking at, are you also looking at if staffing shortages, problems, overloaded staff, if that may be contributing to some of this?
Staffing question is a huge challenge. I wish there were good data that proved that a certain amount of staffing led to better outcomes. We don't have data to say that. I know that many facilities are struggling with the staffing question, and we see this not only in hospitals, but if you compare healthcare 10 years ago to when the 2007 numbers were released, things are different. A lot of care that only used to take place in intensive care units is now being provided on wards. The staffing is not the same. The level of training might not be the same. Similarly, patient care that took place in the wards is now happening in skilled nursing facilities, nursing homes, and with home care. Again, it's not just a matter of do we have enough nursing staff or doctors, it's where are we providing this care. And part of the work that CDC is engaged in right now is making it possible for us to reach into nursing homes and ambulatory surgery facilities to get the same sorts of data that inform our quality improvement questions, just as we're doing in hospitals. As soon as we have information that says staffing should be exactly this, I will be happy to trumpet that. But right now, we don't have a lot of clarity.
Or their family members if the patients are unable to speak for themselves. How do you get people over the intimidation of being in a hospital, saying, challenging a doctor? What's your message to people watching this right now about their, gee, I don't want to be rude,
yeah,
or gee, that's impolite?
It's really hard. When my own mother was in the intensive care unit, I found it hard to pipe up. And if I find it hard, I can't imagine what it's like for everybody else. But what I can tell you is when a friend of mine was recently in the intensive care unit, two of us, another friend and myself, we took turns being the bad cop, and we supported each other. And it's easier to do when you decide up front, I'm going to be the bad cop today. It's hard to do, but it's very important that people try. Do we have a call from the yes, please. Hi, Carrie.
I just had a question when we're using the state figures. So, for example, in Georgia, the CLABSI number is down 33%. I think that's compared to the national benchmark. Would it be accurate to say that, you know, we had a drop within Georgia of 33%? Or is that compared to the national benchmark? So I'm wondering whether that's accurate, given that depending on where Georgia started.
So the depending on where you started is the key to the question. The baseline for many of these numbers is 2006 to 2008, and we've been reporting progress year by year. So continuing to show that same arrow is not as helpful at this point since it's 2014, and that's why we compared it to the national progress level. So when you say that, you know, there's a 30% improvement in Georgia compared to the national, it is really only compared to the national.
Is it accurate to say that, you know, that's a lower number than we've seen nationally for CLABSI? Is that mean, I'm assuming that means Georgia's kind of lagging behind the nation in progress.
So I'm going to let our specialists in that arena address this next. But, again, I think the reason for producing this report at all is to push. Just as I'm being pushy when it comes to asking questions at the bedside, we're also being pushy when it comes to our state colleagues and our healthcare facility colleagues, saying, look, there's more to be done. Paul, Jonathan, do you want to say a word?
Okay, so just to jump in on the state question, Mike is correct. We're comparing back to the national baseline. We do a comparison in the progress report that compares the state progress to the rest of the nation without, with the state excluded, and there is a conclusion that we can make about whether the state's progress is significantly different from the rest of the nation. Again, like Mike also alluded to, that differs between the different infection types. We're not looking at a composite measure as a whole, but the performance does vary infection by infection.
I'll just follow up also by saying that these things tend to taper off, and we don't want to penalize places that are doing a great job because they're down so low that there's not a lot of progress left to make. So you'll see us continuing to work with the issue of baselines and different ways of presenting the data so that we can give a clear picture of how we're progressing, where we need work, but also without taking away the success of a place that's gotten so low that there's nowhere else to go. Do we have a call from the phone, please?
We do have a question from Daniel White, McClathy Newspapers. Your line is open.
Hey, thank you guys for taking my call. The CDC projects that with the $30 million in funding requested by the President's fiscal year 15 budget, that its antibiotic resistance initiative could achieve a reduction in healthcare-associated infection. You guys project that this would save a number of lives, prevent hospitalizations, and cut more than $2 billion in costs. How would the AR initiative accomplish this?
So the AR initiative is in the FY15 President's budget. And it's an investment that's proposed in order to do several things. Improve our ability to track these infections, improve the ability to get the data that tells us where the hotspots are, improve the nation's capacity to do the laboratory testing that's needed to figure out which of these germs is causing the problem, and then also bolster our ability to put, as they say, boots on the ground in places that are having a problem and actually deliver assistance to improve practices. Is there another question on the phone?
Yes, we do have a question from Mary Ann Roser, Austin American Statesman. Your line is open.
Thanks. I'm wondering if we have data on individual facilities and state rankings, and I had a second part to that.
So we do provide hospital-level data through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Hospital Compare website. So our National Healthcare Safety Network CDC data automatically gets handed off to CMS, and they're able to publish those infection rates by hospital with the address for every hospital that they support with CMS money.
So we have those for this year?
Yes.
Okay, and state rankings for the report today, do you have that?
Would you say state rankings?
Like, for example, I'm in Texas. Are we near the bottom, near the top?
Oh, I see what you're saying. No, we don't have that.
Okay.
The problem here is that really you might be at the bottom for one infection type, but you might be leading the pack for another. And so it doesn't really help anybody to say, you know, one state's good or bad.
And just the other question I had was, do you have any advice for the public about using antibacterial soap? And is there a brand you'd recommend? Because I find it very difficult to find antibacterial hand soap.
I understand completely. There is a huge amount of commercial product out there. Really plain soap and water works really well for almost everything, and using it constantly is a good thing. Alcohol hand rubs are a great thing. When I'm transiting an airport, I'm constantly using them. And for some things, antimicrobial soap solutions are very important. So if you're about to have surgery, your doctor may say, take a shower with this soap twice, you know, in the next couple of days so that your infection risk is lower. So there's a role for all of these things, but for routine day-in and day-out use, at my house, I use a nice soap that smells like flowers, and that's fine. You don't need anything special. We have time for two more questions.
Thank you.
Yes, sir, and back. No, we don't come out and say don't use antibacterial soap. We're very specific about where we say it should be used. What we really want people to do, though, is focus on keeping their hands clean all the time, and especially in healthcare settings. Another question on the phone?
Dan Childs, ABC News, your line is open.
Thank you very much for taking my question. With regard to the problem of antibiotic resistance that you were talking about, where are we in terms of new approaches to these untreatable infections that you mentioned, and will we get a second chance to get it right with antibiotics, and if so, when?
Great question. So as a nation, in addition to preventing antibiotic resistance in organisms by better antibiotic use, and in addition to not letting the organism spread from patient to patient with good hand hygiene, good infection control, we're also supporting the generation of new antibiotics. The challenge that we have is that it takes a long time to go from some rare chemical in a jungle to something that we know is safe and effective for human beings. And during that span of time, what we have right now is pretty much it. So a lot of the very intense work that we're doing with regard to antibiotic stewardship and prevention of resistance is about how we keep these handful of antibiotics that still work for us effective and available for the next, who can say, 7 to 8 years maybe, before we have a new truly useful antibiotic that's come through the pipeline. So there's that piece of it. You also talked about other approaches, and there is an interesting area of work that's not completely mature yet, but of other ways to take care of infections. Some of you may have heard about medical honey. There are ways to treat wounds that seem to be successful. If there is overwhelmingly supportive data, we will someday possibly be recommending doing that routinely. We're not quite there yet, but I think the desperation with which some of these infections are being approached is leading to some interesting new approaches. Lastly, the question of will we get a second chance is an important one. There are two pieces to this. One is, once we do have new antibiotics, if we treat them the way we've been treating them up until now, we'll lose those quickly as well, I guarantee it. It's kind of like just ordering a new credit card when you're bankrupt. It doesn't work. The flip side of this, though, is when you don't use an antibiotic for a long time, bacteria stop fighting it. And so one of the medications that we use for the nightmare bacteria is a thing called colistin. It's a terrible drug to use because the side effects are horrible, which is why we never used it very much to begin with. And so it still works. In desperation, we're using that, but there's a possibility that with very good antibiotic stewardship, using less broad-spectrum antibiotics and using them as wisely as possible, we may actually be able to move the needle back a little bit for some of these bacteria.
Thank you.
Thank you. This concludes today's media briefing on healthcare-associated infections. Thank you, Dr. Bell. Thank you, Victoria Nahum. For media attending today's briefing in person, we're happy to be joined by members of the Georgia State Health Department, the Georgia Hospital Association, and the Quality Improvement Organization, and they're available for interview also. For those who are not in the room, media who have follow-up questions or requests for interview, please call CDC's media line at 404-639-3286 or email media@cdc.gov. Thank you.